In 1948, a magazine with a proud name and fast-failing fortunes was purchased by a young man and his partners who believed in it. That young man, Gerard Peel, had recently left his job as science editor of Life magazine. He had decided the time had come to strike out on his own. Today, the magazine Mr. Peel and his associates purchased, Scientific American, is the undisputed world leader in its field, and Mr. Peel is one of the most distinguished men in publishing, in science journalism, and in bridging the increasingly complicated and important gap which exists in our time between the humanities and science. Camera 3 is pleased today, in continuation of its intermittent series, Conversations with Editors, to talk with Mr. Peel and explore Scientific American and the changing American attitude toward technology and science. Mr. Peel, I understand that when you were a student at Harvard University, you managed to go through to your degree and stayed as far away as possible from science courses. Would you say that that's a prerequisite for publishing the most famous science magazine in the world?
I would not. Indeed, I wouldn't. In fact, I don't think anyone can get away with that at Harvard today or at any other college or university in this country. The need for a basic understanding and background in science is as essential to my profession as a science journalist as it is to the functioning a man in his citizenship and in his profession anywhere else in our land and in our culture.
That's a very interesting point, because actually, that's not so very long ago. I don't want to get personal, but you went through to your degree, as many others did, and yet science was not considered at that time as being absolutely vital.
Well, I think we have all learned something in the last 25 years. I am fortunate in having been able to continue my education through the now more than 25 years since I graduated from college. But it has become now clear that an education in science is an essential part of a liberal education as an education in history is. Our worldview in this time is profoundly conditioned and modified by what man has learned through the application of his rational faculties, through the test of evidence, through this marvelous human enterprise which we call science.
Mr. Peel, Scientific American is a very old magazine. What can you tell us about its history?
It was founded in 1845, in the period when the Yankee mechanic first began to acquire his self-consciousness or his social consciousness. And it was founded by one of the socially conscious Yankee mechanics of that time, a peddler and tinker named Rufus Porter. In the 2 years that Porter published Scientific American, the magazine was full not only of fascinating accounts of contemporary developments in technology, basically it was technology, and every issue has a story about a boiler blowing up, and historic ones, boilers that blew up in the battery and threw chunks of hot metal up to where the public library is now. But Porter was also a poet, and there's a charming poem of his with which he celebrated the invention of the telegraph by Samuel F.B. Morse, and this will give you a sense of the kind of joy this man had in science and technology, and how for him it was as much a part of culture as it was of the economic task of extracting society's living from the bounty of the earth. His poem reads, "He who created heaven and earth and gave the rolling thunder birth hath kindly unto Morse revealed what heretofore had been concealed. He, Morse, I take it, doth the rapid lightning tame. A telegraph, he calls its name. And with a single vivid flash, a dot, a space, a line, a dash, can send around the earth the news," and so on. You get a sense that this was a human being and this was a human activity.
One of your admirers, Robert Frost, said that he regarded Scientific American as a very important literary magazine. I guess he didn't know that he was really relating back, in a sense, to Rufus Porter.
Well, that's right, we have looked for poetry for our pages. We found some in the works of Clerk Maxwell, the great British physicist of the last century. I think that Robert Frost's admiration of our magazine as a literary journal, and he spoke of it as one of our foremost literary journals, came from the fact that the articles in our magazine are written by scientists. And their juices, their manhood, their vitality is invested in their work. And they're able to write about it with great vividness and with great feeling and subjective sense of how it works.
Much more recently than 1845, Scientific American has been one of the most fascinating stories in the world and pictures of what has happened to it since you and your associates joined it some 17 years ago. At that time, if my figures are correct, the general circulation was around 40,000, and today it's 400,000.
That's right.
What was the magic formula that brought this tremendous change in such a short time?
Well, there are two elements in the story. One is editorial, and the other is its readership. The editorial side of it is the fact that we are concerned with surely the central enterprise of our culture and civilization. We publish in each issue the greatest diversity of editorial content. We've got our current issue here. For example, our lead issue is about the support of science in the United States. Here we are concerned with the problems of science itself as an enterprise in our democracy. Then, hydroxyl radicals in space. This is the discovery of the fact that something approximating organic molecules, the working parts of organic molecules, that is, the molecules of living things, are floating around in space and are created by the action of solar and stellar energy on inert molecules and atoms in interstellar space. The secondary recovery of petroleum. Here is technology. The pineal gland, physiology and human biology. Ultra-strong magnetic fields. Here we have basic science also verging very strongly today on technology. The role of chlorophyll and photosynthesis. Here is one of the really great questions. All of life on Earth depends upon the photosynthetic process that goes on in green leaves. Ancient Jerusalem. Here, something of the social sciences, archaeology. And we've had perfectly marvelous material on this, which bears on not alone the wondrous works of art and so on of the human past, but also the really basic guts and processes of history. The human and social evolution story, which is told in archaeology as it's conducted today, is of enthralling importance. And then medicine, flies, and disease, a nice hot weather story.
Well, now, who are your 400,000 readers, Mr. Peel?
Our 400,000 readers are laymen who are interested in science. And these laymen include, among the most intensely interested laymen, the scientists and engineers themselves, the men who advance the frontiers of knowledge and the men who are engaged in applying newly won knowledge to the work of society. These make up the large majority of our readership. Then we have a very interesting group of men who have been unfrocked from their professional role as scientists and engineers and have gone on to positions of general management in industry and in government as well. Then we have a large number of not elsewhere classified laymen like myself who recognize that an understanding of science is, well, it's an essential part of citizenship in our time. One can't really cope with public issues as a voter, just to take one single aspect of it, without an appreciation and an understanding of the technological considerations that underlie so much of the making of public policy in our
time. So there's a combination of the emotional appeal that the fascination of science exerts for so many people, plus the sense that it's important to be informed, not only in one single science, but in a diversity.
Right. Well, the man who becomes an engineer ended on his career, went to MIT or Caltech, because he was interested in science in the first place. And later on in his life, in his education, discovered that effective work required narrower and narrower specialization. And he goes on, both in science and in engineering, to become a specialist in one field. But this doesn't mean that he loses for a moment the original inspiration and love for the whole process of the increase of understanding and the relationship of the parts to the whole that inspires a good scientist.
Mr. Peel, this new July issue is not different. It's typical of the attractive format that has evolved in Scientific American, and I think that you are over modest in paying tribute to the readership and to those who write for Scientific American and saying that that's the reason there's been the jump. Certainly, many people are vastly impressed with the artwork and the graphics that is to be found in every single issue. What led to that? Because most certainly it's one of the first things you're aware of when you pick up a copy.
Well, all of us who have been to college are highly verbal in our approach to the world, and we really don't think anything exists until it has a name on it, until it's been expressed in writing and in words. Science deals with wholly new and unfamiliar and novel aspects of nature and wholly new and novel human experiences for which Adam didn't have names in the garden. Science is still in the way carrying on Adam's task of naming things. Now, science has to invent new words and new terms for the things that it discovers and works with in exploring the world around us and exploring our own interiors. The easiest way to show the thing that name has been pinned on is to make a picture of it. Well, that's one primary function. The next is that science deals with the interaction of more than two variables, and most of us have difficulty dealing with just the interaction of two variables at a time. It's the relationships between things at complex and profound levels that science is concerned with. Here again, language can be tortured terribly and not express what is most clearly expressed in an equation, and which can be easily and wonderfully expressed in a diagram or in a chart. Now, to help us in this task of using the graphic arts as well as words to tell the story, we have enlisted the help of a wonderful group of serious artists and painters who, when they're not illustrating the pages of Scientific American, are at work at their own work at their own easels. These men come up with wonderful, original, and imaginative solutions for the task of expressing.
So that you can say that the Scientific American artwork has a life of its own outside of the pages of the magazine.
They do, indeed. Our covers hang in museums, and we have on the road today an exhibition of our paintings and drawings that has been in the museums of a couple of dozen cities. We have published, under the imprint of Simon & Schuster, two portfolios of our artwork.
These have gone out to...
Yes, indeed, and have been sold in bookstores to people who collect these things. The cover of our second portfolio shows corings taken from the ocean's bottom of the sediments at the bottom of the ocean. And these in themselves are things of beauty, as one can see looking at them, and the painter who did it with loving interest and concern with what those corings had to show.
Mr. Peel, we were talking about Robert Frost and his comment about Scientific American. You said that the writers were the scientists who were actually doing the work, who were deeply involved intellectually in the various areas of science. What is the role of the editorial staff of Scientific American?
Well, we've covered one important part of their role, and this is the providing of the illustrations. This is done in collaboration with the author, I may add. Another important function of our editors is to work with our authors on the task of saying it in words. We use the English language in our pages, and there is the task of translation. There is also the task of telling a story. The scientist in a technical journal is talking inside the fraternity to people who know what he's talking about. All they want to get from him is the report of his results and the demonstration of how he got them. To our readers, the task is to develop the relevance of the new work to the fabric of knowledge and to human concerns. And it is on this aspect of it that the author is counseled by our editors. And then I may add, and I don't think our authors will be injured if I say this in public here, that we do a most rigorous kind of editing. I think our magazine is probably the most rigorously edited magazine in our land. And this involves everything from what one would ordinarily call editing to a complete rewriting of the article, a rewriting that is done with the author's consent and collaboration. It's an intense and, we say, often painful collaboration that goes on between our editors and our authors. And the result is, we hope, every month a magazine in which every article is accessible to the readership and understanding of every reader.
Well, your purpose being to achieve maximum communication eventually between your original author and the final consumer.
Well, exactly. And the point is that the work of science has to be carried on by specialists and has to be carried on by men who are working with great intensity in narrower and narrower tunnels, so to speak. On the other hand, we're living in a period of science and in the history of the human thought in which the work of science has arrived at pretty grand conclusions and grand vistas, great generalizations. For example, in the field of biology, within the past 15 years, while we have been publishing Scientific American, the essential underlying mechanisms of the living cell have been elucidated, and one can begin to speak of a general theory of biology. Now, it is important that these great movements be developed in our pages and be brought forward so that the community of people who are concerned and engaged can see the whole picture.
You made the point, Mr. Peel, that actually the interest of Scientific American in the area is a very wide one, and the diversity of scientific approach you brought out in just running down the table of contents for the next issue. What about the special issue, which is a feature each year of Scientific American?
Each September, we devote an issue to a single topic. This is a useful thing for us to do because there are many topics, such as, for example, the living cell, the marvelous culmination of work under this heading, to which we devoted a single issue. There are works of this kind that cannot be covered adequately in a single article, where bringing together a dozen or so authors for a symposium on a single topic makes the whole bigger than the part, so to speak. These issues also have served to cover the very important area of the interface between science and society. In 1952, we devoted a September issue to the subject of automatic control. We're in the midst of a new acceleration in the Industrial Revolution, related specifically to developments in this field through which the human nervous system, we eliminated muscles from the productive process about a century ago, or began to in a big way. Now we're eliminating the nervous system.
And I'd like to mention this one and ask you about it, technology and economic development, because here you would seem to be crossing from science over into the field of social studies in a way.
Well, the content of our magazine from issue to issue embraces the social sciences. Here we're concerned, again, with the interface of science and society. I don't think there is any more profoundly important issue in the world than the question of economic development. It's the opposite side of the other important question, which is the prevention of war.
Wasn't this the issue which involved the Scientific American's development of that input-output table, which
Yes.
has been of such wide importance since that time?
Wassily Leontief, who was the author of this technique, wrote the article on this subject in this issue and was able to demonstrate the wonderful relevance of input-output analysis to economic development in underdeveloped countries.
Now, explain that to us briefly, Mr. Peel.
An input-output table breaks the economic system down into an arbitrary number of industrial or business sectors. And what this table shows us is the inter-industry transactions, the traffic and sales from industry to industry that are so vital in a highly differentiated and specialized economic system and underlie the basic economic processes of our time. What an input-output table shows us is, in other words, the relationship between technology and economics. It is the first technique that brings the realities of the technological order into the grip of economic theory. It's relevant to our mission in another way, in that the input-output relationships, that is, the ratio of an input to an output, and that is to say, the amount of coke that is needed to make a ton of pig iron. The ratio of coke to pig iron in that case is established by technology. Basically, the inter-industry relationships shown in the input-output table are established by technology. They're established by technologists, by scientists, by engineers. In fact, these coefficients, these ratios, are established by the readers of Scientific American in our country. And the table is a dramatic demonstration of the role that the technologist, the scientist, and the engineer plays in the decision-making and in the very life process of our economy.
In a sense, then, this table does for a business and industry what the X-ray does for the individual human being.
Well, exactly. It does show the inner working parts of the system. It shows the gear works, and that term gear works is a nice one because the gear ratios, the input-output ratios, those gears are cut by technologists.
One of the interesting things, of course, in looking, considering Scientific American is that at the end of a month, when your readership has gone through a given issue, that is not the end of the issue. Well, what about off-prints, which is another feature of Scientific American?
In response to prayerful letters from teachers some years ago, we began to reprint articles from back issues. And today we find ourselves about to sell our 10 millionth reprinted article from Scientific American. These have gone into the schools as prescribed reading, adopted just as textbooks are, by teachers to supplement the reading of their students in their various courses. And in fact, a few courses, one at Harvard, a quite distinguished and splendid experiment in the design of a science course for the liberal arts student who's not going to take another science course, was built entirely around Scientific American off-prints. And this kind of course is coming forward in many other institutions.
Were you behind this in a sort of a feeling of penance for not having taken science 25 years ago?
Well, I feel that I've made up for my dereliction as a student.
And I think that we certainly can accept, Mr. Peel. I'd like to come back to that point in a way. We certainly touched on it at the very beginning of our conversation here. Most certainly the school people, science educators and others, have seen the values and have helped to create the demand that the off-prints have satisfied. What would you say to the student today, the high school student or the college student, who is inclined to say, yes, science is wonderful, but it's not my dish of tea. I am interested in the humanities.
I'm constrained to begin by quoting a wonderful line that is heard in Cambridge. You know, MIT has gone very seriously about the task of leavening the scientific and engineering course there with the humanities. And you hear the students at MIT saying, well, if we scientists have got to be humanized, it's high time those humanists up the river at Harvard got Simonized. the fact is that one cannot really live in the 20th century without a participation in this great intellectual enterprise of science. It has not only transformed the environment in which man lives, it fundamentally underlies the transformation of the relationship of man to man in our modern social order. It is the wealth-producing power of modern technology that makes it possible for there to be democratic societies in the world, for citizenship to be not the privilege of the patriciate, but for the process of self-government to become the privilege and responsibility of every citizen in the country.
It's been marvelous to have you today on Camera 3, Mr. Peel, and I hope that we'll have the opportunity to have you back again after Scientific American has gone on with its important job. Until next week, this is Jim McAndrew saying goodbye for Camera 3.